For the past 20 years, Lenny Kamerlin has been creating films about global change. Not changes in the weather, but change in people's lives in the far north. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. Join me as I talk with Lenny Kamerlin, founder and co-director of the Alaska Native Heritage Film Project. Len, glad you're with us today.
Thank you.
Give us an introduction to the Alaska Native Heritage Film Project. What did you have in mind 20 years ago? This is its anniversary. What did you have in mind 20 years ago at its founding?
That's right. Well, 20 years ago, what we intended to do was make one film in each different Native cultural area in the state, to have a total of 7 films. But as we started on that project, really, the films themselves, the needs of Native communities and life itself intervened to change it.
When you say we, this is a 20-year collaboration
between
you and Sarah Elder.
That's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we'll introduce Sarah a bit later as we go into the film, as we go into our discussion today. Can you talk to me about how you see Alaska Natives or Native Americans in general have been perceived in film, portrayed in film prior to the project? I think this has something to do with why the project was founded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the image of Native people in films from really the when films first started has always been very very negative, portrayed as the savage innocence or kind of childlike or with really very little to do with the reality of how people saw themselves in their own lives. It's almost as if the filmmakers had this image of this kind of, Garden of Eden of, innocent life where everything is spiritual and wonderful, and portrayed that image in film. And it really has created many stereotypes throughout the years.
Say more about the filmmaker than the subject.
That's right. These stereotypes have really become a part of how people think about Native culture. And unfortunately, in some instances, they become a part of how Native people think about themselves when they see these films, how they take these images on.
Did you and Sarah sit down consciously and think about that as you determined to make films about Alaskans in Alaska?
I think so, but more than that, I think we were both trying to interpret our own first experiences of living in Native villages and what we saw, and the relationships and experiences that we had there. For me, I came to Alaska in 1965 as a VISTA volunteer. I was 19 years old and very impressionable, right out of New York City. Mm. And when I got there, I was really astonished that the reality that I found was so different from all of these images that I had in my head about Alaska, Eskimo life. And in thinking about that, I realized that really all of those images came from television, came from movies. And I started to think how really profound that is for all of us in this age, in this time, that much of what we know about the world, the images we think of when we think of other places, other people, really come from films and from television. It's a very powerful medium, and it's really changed the way that humans think about themselves and the world.
Did you know you were going to make film then?
No, I didn't at all. I was more interested in still photography, and it's a little bit of documentation there, just my own work. which later became a small book. But no, I didn't. And but that experience was very formative, and then later I really looked back on that and trying to figure out how to translate that experience in film, how to, even if it's possible, for people of one culture to make films, to document the lives of other cultures, and have those films not be about themselves, their own background, their own training, their own way of seeing things. And basically, for the next 18 years, Sarah and I have been answering and re-answering that question and refining the way that we came up to deal with that.
We're talking with Lenny Kamerling. Leonard, as I said, is the co-founder of the founder, rather, of the Alaska Native Heritage Film Project, has been co-director since 1974 with Sarah Elder. The project celebrates its 20th anniversary in 1992. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. You have said of you and Sarah that you are more translators than you are filmmakers. Translate?
Yeah, yes. I mean, we are translators of experience. Our films, they're not informational films. They don't have a narrator that tells you, that gives the audience information. What they do really is create an experience of what it's like to be in the villages. We were never interested in communicating in the films, you know, the facts that people can find in books, like, anthropological facts. You know, what we were interested in is trying to capture how it felt to wake up in the morning and be from that culture, be from that group. And maybe I should talk a little bit about the way that we have made our films, that to try to really deal with this problem of, can outsiders make a film about another culture that truly represents that culture? We devised an approach that we've come to call community collaborative filmmaking. And what this is a collaborative, cooperative decision-making between the subjects of the film and the filmmakers as to what the film should be about, what themes it should cover, what should be said, who should be in it, who should represent the community. And this collaboration continues from the inception of the film all the way through till its completion.
Do you go in with an idea, or you go in with a desire to create? How open is your plan before you get to the community?
It's quite open, because for one thing, this community collaborative approach, it doesn't have a very firm methodology. I mean, it's not a methodology cast in stone, because in a lot of ways it has to be reinvented in every new community, because every community is slightly different. So we go in very open. We don't do a great deal of research before we go in, because we feel that to do too much research, you start to predetermine the look of the film. You start to get interested in certain areas. Mm-hmm. And that has to come from the experience of living in the place, the kinds of changes you go through, the way you're seeing, your vision changes after you've been in a place for a while, and the changes that happen to all of us through this process of collaboration.
So this is a living-in experience. You don't go in for 10 days and make a film.
No, it's an extended period, usually 3 or 4 months has been the average, sometimes longer.
Isn't this a very thin thread for a filmmaker? You and Sarah getting on a plane with all your equipment and going to Imonic to make a film.
It is, but it's very different kind of filmmaking. You know, we don't have a script. We don't really have a plan of what the film will be about. And it is quite thin, and it is
scary.
Insecure. Huh. Yeah. And sometimes even into the project, you know, I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning with my heart pounding, you know. We don't have a film. When is this going to happen? But we've learned to trust this process, and the process takes time. And it's a process of self-discovery.
There are 11 films to date created and completed by the Alaska Native Heritage Film Project, the first in 1972, the most recent in 1989. There is another which Lenny is working on, not with Sarah, but with William Parrott of the University of Alaska Fairbanks, which is not on Alaska, but which is on Japan, that is in the works, and that will be the 12th film that the project has created. I want to ask about a film that you finished in 1976 called On the Spring Ice.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that whatever idea you went into that film with, life changed it completely.
That's
and this
right.
is a good example. Can you tell
That's
us
right.
what happened with On the Spring Ice?
Well, we were filming in Gamble, St. Lawrence Island, and we had been there for about a month without doing any filming at all. Usually, when we go into a new community, we don't film for the first month at all. That's really an important kind of period to acclimatize. And after our meetings there, and it was decided that we should film whaling, which was just coming up seasonally. We were out early one morning filming a group of men up on a roof, looking out to the sea into the open ice, trying to spot whales that were migrating past, when somebody realized that some hunters that were out walrus hunting from the night before hadn't returned. And that just happened while we were filming. And so we just went on and continued throughout the day as this drama, you know, unfolded.
So what you filmed was the decision-making by the community, how to deal with the lost hunters and
right.
their rescue?
What ensues is this long dialogue where the decision is made about what to do and how to deal with it, all from the perspective of the village, of these men sitting on the roof.
Huh.
And it was one of those things where just life intervened and became part of the film.
What is it like working collaboratively with one other person for 20 years? It seems to me that you and Sarah must have brought different gifts, talents, ambitions to the project.
Oh, absolutely. I think these films really would be very different if either one of us had made them individually. We bring very diverse kinds of skills, and we're different people, and our personality is also very diverse. And that's been very complementary in this kind of work. And but mainly we both have the same worldview and about this work and about its importance. And I think from the beginning we both looked at the cultures that we worked with not as exotic cultures, but as, you know, American cultures who were part of, you know, the greater American experience, whose lives and, you know, work really deserved sharing with everybody else.
And what do you hope for? What have you hoped for the viewer, for the rest of America, as they see your film?
Well, that's a good question. What I hope is that when people see the films, that they have a sense of participation. You know, that they're not sort of lulled into the background. Like with many cultural documentaries, the audience is not brought in as participants. They're spoon-fed information by a narrator, and I feel, and Sarah feels, that this really sets the audience up to be passive. And it changes the way people look at them, at the images, and it changes the way they listen to the dialogue. And these films are specifically designed to not do that. Mm-hmm. There's no narrator. And the lack of a narrator makes people relate to the material and watch the material in a very different way. Also, the pace of the editing is slower. The style of the editing is done to really create an experience to approximate the sense of time of being in a community, in a native community. And if we can communicate that to people, then that's something very important. Most importantly is that if through these films people can share some of the experience we had, which was to make contact with people and to have the barriers of language, of culture, of time and place sort of, vanish, and to really feel, you know, a human connection. That's a very special and rare thing. And if the films can translate that, then I think that's a very, very valuable thing, because then the stereotypes fall away as well.
How do you create that balance? When you've talked about we want to stay with a subject, our process of editing is slower than, mm-hmm. or the result is slower than. How do you balance that with the belief that Americans can't pay attention for any longer than a 30-second news bite or 12 minutes at the very most, which seems to be the average people say about us? Are you aware of that? Will people
yes.
watch this?
Yeah, I think they will. I think it's these films are somewhat of a different experience for people, but I think it's the responsibility of the filmmaker, through the way the film is put together, to teach the audience how to watch it.
To stay with you.
Yeah, to teach the audience how to watch the film, what's expected of them, and to give them a sense what they're going to get from the experience. Mm. And that all has to happen in the first 5 minutes, because if you don't have your audience committed to the film in the first 5 minutes, that's it. You've lost them.
So in some ways, your filmmaking is traditional, in as much as you have to have a grabber, a kicker, something at the beginning to capture the audience.
Yes, right.
And ways to make them stay with you as you go along.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you work with translations? A number of your films, Drums of Winter, for example, has people speaking in their own language, subtitles, some voiceovers.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. How do you maintain the integrity of the language and also allow it to communicate?
That's one of the most important parts of the editing process, because the language is so important. You know, even if people don't understand the language, just hearing it conveys an emotional message that's very important. That's why we never use voiceover narration. We always use subtitles. The language is really very important, and in subtitling it into English, a lot of times you have to make important compromises, because to translate the language literally sometimes does not convey the true meaning. And so you have to go a little bit of a circuitous route and not be quite literal in order to get at the real meaning of the language. And we've always felt that the integrity of the language was really essential, was very, very important.
Once again, we're talking with Lenny Kamerling. Lenny was educated at Franconia College in Franconia, New Hampshire. It was through the Franconia College outreach program that he came to Alaska as a VISTA volunteer community organizer in 1965 and 1966. In 1968 and 69, he went to the London School of Film Technique. His first film was called One Dot for Apple. It was created in 1970 about a school for the blind.
That's right.
I have another question about the perspective that you and Sarah have brought to cross-cultural filmmaking. I have read that the two of you created in that process a set of guidelines that had never been present before for other ethnographic filmmakers. How have you polished these guidelines and put them out for the world to use and see?
Well, over the years, they've become more widely accepted. And like I said before, really, the guidelines have to be more or less reinvented with every, you know, with every community. But kind of the loose guidelines are an extended stay in the village. No filming for the first month, or very, very little, maybe just environmental things. And most importantly, that anybody can stop the filmmaking at any time if they feel that it's, you know, trespassing into grounds that they're not happy with. In Bethel, when Sarah did the filming for the film Everyday Choices, which is about how Bethel is dealing with their alcohol problems, this was a very important part of the guideline, that anybody could stop the filming at any time. Nobody did. But I think just knowing that they had the power to do so created a kind of trust and created access for, you know, for the filmmakers that wouldn't have been there otherwise.
In that case, or in any case, did Sarah sit down with a whole group of people to discuss the creation of this film, or did she go from one to the other, or a little of both?
I think a little of both. The most important thing in starting this process is to really find out how that community makes its decisions. So if we come into a community and want to, you know, hold a meeting and have everybody come to discuss how the film should be put together, and that community, and that's not the way the community makes its decisions by public meeting, then you know, nothing happens, nothing will be done. So that we learned through our mistakes, through being at meetings and, you know, having nothing happen, being embarrassed. So really, it's learning that process and then reflecting that process in how the project is, how this community collaborative process is followed.
How are your films used after they're produced?
Oh, they're used very widely. Here at UAF, they're used quite intensively and all through the state. Always in demand by Native communities. And they've really been seen worldwide on television and through non-theatrical distribution.
The films have won a great number of awards, over 20 in the 20 years that they have been produced, national awards, some more than once, as early as 1970, 77, the two, Lenny and Sarah, were given the Special Honors Award by the American Film Festival for winning first prize for three consecutive years. That was only achieved by one other filmmaker in the 20 years at that time of the festival's existence. The most recent award for Drums of Winter, a film about drumming and dancing in Imonik, was taken by the given by the International Ethnographic Film Festival as late as 1991. Two other awards for that film in 1990 as well. Total of five awards for drums.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
How do you create emotional impact and content through your films? Emotions are something that keep the viewer watching, and mm-hmm. also show what you're trying to show. Do you find it as you go along?
We find it as we go along. You know, in the editing process, as you get to know your material more, the gems, you know, the wonderful pieces you have sort of emerge, and often that changes. You know, sometimes as the process goes on and the film takes shape in the context of the forming work, other things start to show up as being important. So, they're there. And you have to really listen closely to the material.
Are eyes and ears very different in the process of filmmaking? Does that make sense to you? Do you hear differently than you see, and is that important?
I think so, yeah. I think so. Of course, when we're filming, you know, I am the eyes because I am, you know, the camera operator, and Sarah is the ears, and she is recording sound. But also, she's a second set of eyes. And in the Drums of Winter, much of it, which was filmed in a dance house, the context was very important. It's a small space, and the men sit, the drummers and singers sit on benches facing the dancers, and all around this circular small space are spectators. So the context of what's happening everywhere is really critical to the understanding of the dance. And so very often, even while I was shooting, I had one eye on Sarah, who mm-hmm. was always searching around the context for the next logical place for the camera to move.
Are the two of you moving around a dance house constantly in that situation?
Usually I was moving somewhat, yeah, but the sound usually had to be still. But this is, you know, the kind of communication that after years of collaboration,
yeah.
it's completely nonverbal, and it's another language that's becomes very fluent and very important.
Just watching and knowing where she is, where you are.
That's right, yeah. Right.
How do you keep the filmmaking from getting in the way of the creation of the film?
Well, if the filmmaking is, you know, it's a technical process. And the making of the film is a kind of a separate process. It's a process of collaboration and a process of this opening up to the place and to the subject as the time goes on. And we've always seen the filmmaking process as being something very separate. It's a technical process. It doesn't have a lot to do, you know, with the vision of the film. It's hardware. It doesn't think.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is Conversations. Today we're talking with Lenny Kamerling. He is the founder and co-director of the Alaska Native Heritage Film Project, I'm Susan McGinnis. In this way, can Lenny in the camera and Sarah in the microphone be invisible within the dance house and pull your equipment out later to create that film?
You're never invisible. And in the beginning, with our first films, I wanted that feeling of invisibility in the films. But more and more, you know, we started to see that that it's impossible, and it really is reflecting. It's reflecting a situation that doesn't really exist. We are there. Mm-hmm. The camera and the lights are very invasive, and our being there does change the reality. You know, when you talk about the documentary truth, of which there really is no documentary truth. And more we started to acknowledge that presence in the films, because we are there and it does change things. But I think that what makes that filming possible is the relationship between the community, between the subjects and the filmmakers. Really, I mean, the backbone of this process and these films is trust. That trust exists so that people can go about their business with the presence of all this, you know, paraphernalia and these two people there. Without that trust and this whole process to try to form that trust, these films would be impossible.
What do you mean when you say documentary truth? What does that image conjure in your mind?
That's, I always ask myself that. And basically, you know, what we see on the screen that we take for
the real thing.
The real thing is not the real thing. It's still fiction. I mean, it's still a form of fiction, but it's a different kind of fiction. And by fiction, I mean that ultimately people are taking these images and deciding how to arrange them. And you know, most people don't realize how much that reality can be changed and manipulated to present something very different, I mean, completely different. So it's really not a documentary truth. In this case, what it is, it's a kind of an agreement between Sarah and I and the subjects of what this interpretation of truth will look like and sound like and feel like on the screen.
So the questions are for all of you, the people you're filming, and Sarah and you, does this look like whale hunting? Does this feel like alcoholism in Bethel?
Right.
Does this feel like a sea hunt? Does this feel like getting lost?
Right, right. And when people see the films, you know, for them to, the way they respond to it tells us if we've been successful or not.
It's a long time to wait.
That's a long time to wait, but it's an important wait. And the work that goes into this with this agreement that I was talking about is really critical. And Sarah and I have taken this responsibility very, very seriously for the simple reason that, you know, 20 years from now, if some young person from one of these communities comes to see our films to find out about their culture, what are they going to see? Are they going to see a film that really represented how their own relatives, how their own people saw and spoke about their lives? Or are they going to see shortcuts by filmmakers?
I was going to ask you, is this why you can't ever take shortcuts?
That's precisely why. the responsibility is really, it's too great to do that. And it has too much of implications, you know, for the future, to take shortcuts.
If you go out to a community and film for 4 months, or into Hokkaido, Japan, as you did this last year, and film for 7 months, you have to just have an overwhelming amount of film. And then, isn't there going to be selection and omission?
Sure. Yeah, of course.
Well, two questions in there. The first one is, aren't you overwhelmed sometimes?
Very often. Yes. What happens is when we first come back from the field, we have all of this material. You know, what's still the freshest is the experience of being there. You know, the relationships we have with people. And then comes the process of starting to become familiar with the material as film. As
not
material.
Life, but film.
Not as snapshots, reminders of our experiences. And that's kind of an important step, to get that one step backwards of objectivity, to start looking at the film. And we look at it a lot. We look at it over and over and over. We take notes and talk about, just on a very kind of feeling level, what hits us, what we like, what we don't like. Then comes a process of logging everything, where every single shot is identified, described, and written down in a logbook.
When you say every single shot, is this every frame?
No, this is
the film.
Camera on to camera off.
Right.
That's a shot, right? And this log really helps us in the editing, because you have to have some way to find your material. When you have 40 or 50 hours worth of film, if you need a shot of, you know, putting a fish trap in the ice, you can't start looking through hours of film to find it.
Do you and Sarah do that personally?
We do that, yeah.
You don't hire someone to do it for you?
No, we do that. And that's another way to become familiar with the material. Uh-huh. But you know, let me say also that these films really are the story, the drama, the structure is created in the editing room. Because we don't film according to a script. You know, we record events, we record interaction, people's lives as they're living it. We come home with all of this material that doesn't necessarily have a structure to it. We have to find the structure and then edit accordingly. And Sarah is the one who is the editor, and she puts this material together as we both sit there and hammer it out.
I wonder if sometimes you both don't go screaming from the editing room.
No, we do.
Good, okay.
We do.
Mm-hmm. Once again, we're talking with Lenny Kamerling. Among Lenny's films with Sarah Elder, People of the Tununuk, did I say that right?
People of Tununuk.
Tununuk, the first film in 1972.
Mm-hmm.
You had films in 1972, 73, 74, and then took a jump to 1976. Just about every year during the 70s, there were films on people dealing with changing times. Another one, A Departure, Four Young Men Tracing the Original Route of the Gold Rush. Three Hunters Trapped on Sea Ice, we mentioned that, is called On the Spring Ice. At the Time of the Whaling is one of the best known films created by the collaborative team of Kamerling and Elder. The most recent film, again, Drums of Winter, was completed in 1989. Is there ultimately a balance to storytelling and the science of filmmaking that you try to achieve? You are telling a story.
We're telling a story. And you know, one of the great faults of cultural documentaries, specifically ethnographic films, is that they don't have a story. I mean, they present kind of cultural behavior as data.
These are the people of the far north.
Right, right. And many more are about the external world of different cultures and not about, you know, their emotional world. A good example of this is National Geographic. They do wonderful things, but much of their cultural stuff, you know, you see a picture with a caption, Maasai herder takes his cows to market. I mean, there's nothing about who he is.
You don't know who he is.
You don't know anything about the person's life. And much of ethnographic filming really has been like that. I was at giving a lecture once, and a famous ethnographic filmmaker said to me, said to the group, "You can't be loyal to ethnographic film and storytelling both. It's either one or the other."
And you would say to him?
That's not true. That if you're making films for scientists or for anthropologists, maybe that's true. But we never really have done that. We wanted always to make films for the public, not solely for anthropologists, but to change the way people thought about culture and to change the questions that they asked about culture and even about their own cultures.
And what do you think watching a film on the spring ice or the drums of winter can teach non-Native Americans about non-Native Americans?
I think it can teach them something very important, because I think it can connect them kind of to the humanity of people and not the exoticness, the perceived exoticness of the culture. But, you know, people can watch the films and identify with their concerns. You know, mothers worrying about their kids' future. I mean, these are themes that come up over and over in our films. Change, you know. They're universal themes. And if you take away the exoticness or see them free from the stereotypes that are very pervasive, then, you know, you have people looking at other people who are, you know, often concerned about the same things. And when people make that connection, it's a very powerful thing. I know it was for me in the past and continues to be as I do this work.
Is this interest of yours one of the things that's taken you to Japan for the latest project?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's a good example, because Japanese and American relations are fraught with, you know, the worst kinds of stereotypes. And this was kind of a coming together of my work and Bill Parrott's work. He has been studying small schools in small communities in rural Japan. And we decided to combine our efforts and make a film about learning. How learning is expressed in people's daily lives. And what it became really is a film about family life in a small northern farming community in central Hokkaido.
This, let me just say, so that people will know, Bill Parrott is William Parrott, a professor of secondary education at the Department of Education here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, also associated with the College of Rural Alaska. He spent several summers visiting and teaching in Japan and has written extensively on Japan and the learning process.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
You have, since 1981, 82, been back and forth to Japan, is that right?
I spent a year in Japan in 1982 on a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship. And since then, I've been back a number of times, specifically in setting up this project.
Tell me what the project comes down to. What did you learn? This may be totally unfair, so tell me if it is. What did you learn about Japan that you feel is the most useful, interesting for American audiences?
Several things. One is looking at a small school in a rural area of Japan and seeing what a community looks like that has the value of learning and education as a part of the fabric of life and culture there. And also to see what a town looks like that lives in a country that has, as one of its major commitments to its people, education and healthcare. It's pretty extraordinary to see.
What are some of those parts? How does the small community deal with learning when it values education? What did you see in your filming?
Well, for one thing, the school we were in has 38 students and a staff of 9. 10 miles away is another little town with a school with 10 students and a staff of 4. You know, any place in America, those schools would have been joined together just, you know, to save money.
We wouldn't call that cost effective.
It's not cost effective at all. Mm-hmm. And really, the Japanese educational system isn't cost effective in that way. But it's very fair. It's a centralized system. And so basically, children all over the country get the same education from the same books, learn the same things. And so students of all different, from all different economic backgrounds have access to the same education, at least in the beginning in elementary school.
How did this evolve as such a high value?
I'm not sure, but I think learning and education has always been, you know, a part of Japanese culture. The illiteracy rate there is infinitesimal. Hmm. 0.0 something. But in this film, it's very interesting because the line between school education and home education was very hazy, and it was often difficult to find. And that was remarkable and really quite different from small communities in Alaska and in America, where that line is quite distinct. We really had an extraordinary opportunity there because we were given 7 months carte blanche, complete access to this school. We could film anything. Teachers' meetings, conversations, classes, parents' visits, anything we wanted. So I think this is really the first time that we know of that researchers, filmmakers, foreigners have been given this kind of access into the educational system. Mm-hmm. And I think our collaborative approach really put people at ease and created some confidence with the officials who gave us this access.
Did you learn Japanese for this project?
I did, yes.
And Bill?
Bill too, yeah. But I've been struggling with Japanese for many years.
Mm-hmm. So you could sit down and discuss this in the language of the people?
Yes, yes.
That make it much easier or much harder for you?
It made it harder in the beginning because my language skills were not proficient enough to really engage on the level that I wanted to. But my friend Michio Hoshino, who is a very well-known wildlife photographer who lives in Fairbanks, advised me to not use interpreters, even if it was a great struggle. And he was right. And it was a struggle, but ultimately it just created a kind of one-on-one relationship that made this film possible. And people learned how to talk to me, given the deficiency in my language. Uh-huh. And, we could interview and talk about things, and it worked quite well. Mm. No foreigners had ever come to this community before. Huh. And both Bill and I felt that responsibility very heavily, that our interaction really was going to form the way people thought about foreigners.
You were representing the world.
We were, in a way. And we took that very seriously every day. So I think it'll be a very interesting film. I'm pleased with the material that we have. And if we're successful in showing American audiences Japanese family life free from stereotypes and being able to connect with this human common denominator, I think we'll be very successful.
I want to look at time for a moment. Mm-hmm. You spent 7 months filming, the better part of 4 years before that, setting this project up, creating relationships with people. Now you'll come home and create an editing process that may take, what, a year and a half?
It may take a year or a year and a half, right.
Is there ever a point where you say, I'm tired of this film, I've done this film, just because it's not done doesn't mean I'm not done?
Yes, yeah, very often.
What happens when you do that?
Well, I go home and, come back the next day refreshed. But so many people have made enormous commitments to this project and to all of our other projects. And so many people have put their trust in it that the thought of disappointing so many people is really unbearable and unacceptable. But, I think every filmmaker, every researcher has this kind of frustration, and, you just go back and you do it.
It's another aspect of trusting the process?
That's right. It's exactly that. Mm-hmm. And usually in most of our films, parts of the material are so rich that even in working with them over a year or even years in some cases, we're always discovering new things that we had never seen before. And so that tells us that the process isn't old, it continues on. And that, we still have a lot to learn from it.
Have you stopped and thought about what 20 years as a filmmaker has given to the man who is Leonard Kamerling? It seems to me it must be a phenomenal list.
Yeah, probably too long to list out. But what it's given me most of all is an opportunity to go to a lot of different places, a lot of different cultures, really live in a way that is a great privilege to live and to be led in on a way of life that that most people don't have a chance to see, and also to be given that responsibility of then translating that in a way that makes sense to American audiences.
Is that as much a pleasure as a responsibility to do that?
Has well, it it's a both. It's a pleasure to have that responsibility. And to have done it in, you know, in a way that's worked, that has made both cultures happy. You know, I called Savunga the other day, looking for somebody's phone number, and the guy on the other side said, oh, are you Kamerling who, are you Kamerling and Elder who made those films in 74? They were good films, and that was very unexpected, and that
nice.
Made me feel very nice, you know, that the films are remembered and that they're used, and that they've really filled the vacuum. And so if people can show those films in the village and have their children and grandchildren see them and feel proud, then that's something very special. I think we've accomplished a lot just in that.
I think this might be falling from the sublime to the ridiculous, but I do want to ask you about it. You have filmed in 40 Below with a headwind.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn about equipment and bodies in learning to put films together in the far north?
Well, we learned that the equipment likes to stop and fall apart, or the bodies want to be inside. But you know, we've had many problems with the environment, with filming in cold weather. For example, in From the First People, there's a scene where people are going to check their fish traps, which are under the ice, and it was in colder, 50 below. And when we were filming, the sound cables broke, and we had to go back and do similar parts of it, progressive parts of it, over a period of days. We would have 10 minutes to film before everything froze up, and then put those 5 days together as one continuous action. We've learned to adapt.
Are there some things you don't try anymore because it's just too cold or it's just too something?
Well, at a certain point, you know, we don't film outside, but really our films have been taking us more inside. Our earlier films were more about the external environment, what people did in their environment. And as we progressed and matured as filmmakers and as people, you know, the internal environment became more accessible to us. And I think we're more and more we're moving in that direction.
What's next? You have a film that's going to circle the top of the globe in mind, is that right?
That's right. I'm starting work on a project now that I'm calling Five Families, that really reflects my own interest in what family life has to tell about people's cultures, how they interact with, a family interacts within itself, with others, in the extended community. And this film will be about five families throughout the circumpolar, five native families throughout the circumpolar area. Alaskan Native family, a Siberian Native family, a Sami family in Lapland, Ainu family, the indigenous people of Japan, of northern Japan, and a Greenland family.
Have you begun that process of making connections with these people yet?
I've begun, yes. And
Is this the most ambitious in terms of miles and cultural groups?
It's the most ambitious project in size and in miles, in time, and also in weaving in and out of different cultures, and trying to pull together this series of how families live and what each family has to tell us about their own culture, and ultimately what that has to tell us about ourselves and how we live in our own culture.
Mm-hmm. This is going to be a series rather than one film.
Right, five film series, five-part series.
Do you work in film over videotape because of the qualities of one or the other?
We've always worked in film, in 16-millimeter film. This Japan project was my first venture into video, and it was very interesting. Mm-hmm. Some things are difficult about the transition, some things were very good. The fact that it was immediately accessible, interactive, that people could come and see the material right away, was an enormous asset in Japan. However, the quality of the film, ability of film to record subtleties in light and to create mood with light is much more difficult, if not missing, in video. Or perhaps it's just my inexperience in the medium.
Mm. So 16-millimeter film would always be your preference?
Would always be my preference, uh-huh. Yeah.
Uh-huh. George Bernard Shaw said that when he got up in the morning, he had to kick ideas out of the way. I get that, it's the sense that that's so for your life as well.
Mm. That's right.
Are there films in your mind 20 years ahead?
There are. Definitely there are. And there are films that, ideas that have occurred to me that haven't happened, you know, that were abandoned. And always thinking ahead. Mm-hmm. There are many other films that I'd like to make if time exists to make them in.
Let us hope.
Yeah.
Lenny Kamerling, thanks.
Thank
very
you.
Much.
My pleasure.
Lenny Kamerling has for 20 years, mostly with the collaboration of his co-director and partner Sarah Elder, been making films for the Alaska Native Heritage Film Project at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. This is that project's 20th anniversary. We wish it 20 more. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations. Thanks for listening, and I hope you join me again next week.